Houston Rowdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Hour 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So obviously, the Ebola story is not going away. A Spanish nurse was the first person known to have contracted the virus outside Africa. And this morning, Thomas Eric Duncan, he's the patient in Texas, he died. Earlier today, prior to learning of Duncan's death, we did a reality check with Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Here's that interview.
Last week, Art, when we spoke with you, we talked about the fact that you thought there should be more of a plan. You know, if you have a neighbor or someone in your family or you yourself thinks you might have symptoms of Ebola, what do you do? A week later, we have the president talking about additional screening protocols for passengers both overseas and in the United States looking for Ebola. But we don't really have a plan yet, do we?
We don't. And I'm a little irritated that we still don't have those screening measures in place. They're way overdue. They should have been taking temperatures, asking questions, big signs up. If you see someone sick on the plane or the train or the boat, you report to who, and here's the number. You know, we talked a little bit about quarantine. We've seen one case now in Dallas. They said they put a police car outside the door. I thought that was nice. And if the person came out the door and started running away, you would do what? Shoot them? Taser them? Tackle them? Ask them to please stop? In other words, if the cop thinks they've got Ebola, what are they going to do with them? So, we do, and by the way, one of the things, sadly, that came up in this Spanish situation is dealing with pets. They've got a dog in there. They're talking about euthanizing the dog. I'm not sure why they can't wait to see if the dog gets disease symptoms just like a human did, quarantine the dog too and observe. But we're a long way from having people say, yep, I know the 6 hospitals in Boston where I should go if I thought a visitor to me had Ebola. Or I know the signs and symptoms exactly of what I'm looking for to worry about that particular disease and so on. Just not where we should be.
You know, I always hesitate. Well, actually, I never hesitate to question the slowness of response to something, even though I don't have expertise in the area. You just mentioned Boston, and we've been celebrating for a year and a half the incredible readiness of all of these hospitals on April 15th of a year ago to deal with 100 and some patients and keep every single one of them alive. Why are we having such trouble dealing with what seems to me fairly basic protocols and things? What's taking so long?
And who's supposed to do it?
Well, I think there's a diversity of agencies, and that's a problem. You've got city public health, state public health, CDC. The law sort of gives each of them a piece of the pie in dealing with infectious disease, but it makes for a little Tower of Babel when you start saying, whose job is this? Who's on top of this? Who's in charge here? So you might say having authority go down to the local level sounds good, but it actually leads to a kind of cacophony of different groups issuing different principles, confusing one another. I think the other reason is the public health resources have been depleted over the years. We've been cutting them in different parts of the country, and that's a bad idea in a world of planes, trains, and automobiles. Diseases can get here quickly, so they're understaffed and overwhelmed. That's a problem. And sometimes I think even in our competitive healthcare marketplace like Boston, everybody wants to say, yep, we're the place to come and we're all set for this and we can do this and that, but they may not be sharing their plans. I mean, I don't know why they're not all up on websites saying, you know, here's what we've got, here's what we've got, here's what we've got, don't bring them here, don't come here. But there's a kind of marketplace mentality that you don't share your secrets.
You know, I wouldn't have added one item to your list of potential obstacles until last night, and the thing I'd add is politics. I'm going to play for you a soundbite that is epic. This is Arkansas Democratic Senator Mark Pryor. He's running for re-election. He's losing, apparently, right now, this guy by the name of Cotton. He's asked by MSNBC if he thinks the president of his own party is handling the Ebola crisis well, and it's pretty clear he's saying to himself, I can't say anything good about the president, even on something like a public health crisis, or I'm going to lose my re-election. Here's Pryor.
Do you think that the Obama administration has done an appropriate job handling the Ebola crisis?
It's hard to know because I haven't heard the latest briefing on that, to know all the details. I mean, I read the paper and all, but
What an embarrassment. So is politics part of this, too, that even on something like this, we can't come together? Is that part of the deal?
Yeah. I think, by the way, about 45 seconds into, I think we kind of got the message out of him. So it is politics. There's politics all over the place. By the way, here's a question. Where's the Surgeon General? Remember that person?
Oh, yeah. Where is the Surgeon General?
Used to pop up and give speeches and educate us about diseases and all that sort of thing.
What a great question. What a great question.
What's the answer to the question?
There isn't one. The NRA.
Oh, that's right. Of course.
I was going to say, who is the Surgeon General? I didn't know. Now I know why I didn't know.
There's a little politics for you, right? I mean, they got there's this Harvard doc who's been nominated. He's lost in gun war lands, and we're in the middle of a public health crisis. And you see the CDC guy on, but he's doing double duty. The Surgeon General is supposed to be part of the education of Americans about this.
We should be clear, by the way, because I spoke over you a minute ago. The reason we don't have a Surgeon General is because the guy that the president wanted, this guy from Harvard, says that gun issues are actually public health issues,
yes,
and the Republicans are apoplectic over that. Is that not why we have
that? That is correct.
Okay,
and, you know, let me just say, for the Surgeon General appointment, I would think you're going to tick off somebody. Some people don't want to talk about condoms. Some people don't want to talk about guns. Some people are going to want to talk about fast food. You ought to just appoint the guy who's qualified. He's qualified. Making his appointment political this way doesn't make any sense, but it makes less sense in the era of Ebola.
You know, Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist here, speaking of politics, as we were just a second ago, Governor Rick Perry, of course, he's a Republican. He ran for president last time around. He may be running again. I don't know. But he's calling for more screening at all U.S. points of entry at the borders. And I'm wondering how much of that is politics, you know, bringing up the immigration thing that people are sneaking over the border from Mexico with Ebola, or how legitimate that call is. Is that a good thing to do at all the borders?
No, because there's no disease in Central or South America. I consider that fear-mongering. It's sort of like the infected hordes are coming at us along the Mexico border. One of the realities is, if you looked at the situation of health, we take those refugees, a lot of them women, a lot of them young children, make them sleep on floors in holding areas, and that's how they communicate disease. So if we really wanted to do something about disease, you might find better housing for the people that are in holding situations there. That might get the governor's attention.
Okay. Now, we're talking about the United States. This story about Spain, according to this New York Times piece, was pretty upsetting when you read it. A couple of things. First of all, that they said that this woman who had the nurse that has come down with Ebola was an assistant nurse and only entered the patient's room twice, once after his death, which apparently is a very bad time in terms of infection. But that only entering the room twice kind of jarred me a bit.
You know, again, we have situations, some hospitals have trained staff used to dealing with either infected patients, TB, we're going to give it to others, or patients that you don't want to infect, somebody after a bone marrow transplant. Other places are using volunteers. I don't know why students or someone without much experience would be around these cases anyway. And you know what the problem is, and I don't know this happened, but I'm going to speculate since no one from Spain is going to come and correct me anyway. It may be that they got into trouble taking the equipment off. One of the tough things with those suits and so on is making sure you're very, very careful if it's got something on it, not to get exposed at that point. And so training is crucial.
And hey, Art, last question, if I can, just on Ebola. I'm sorry, Marjorie, what was your...
Well, the second thing I was going to say about Spain is that what raises people's nerves is that this was supposed to be the place that they sent the Ebola patients to, yet the story says at the end that it had no... the hospital has no unit that's specialized to treat infections like Ebola. So it raises the specter, of course, that maybe we're better in the United States, medically speaking, but other countries where patients might end up are out of their league completely.
Possible. Don't know about the Spanish situation. I do know this. We've sent some people with Ebola back to France, and they got some drugs, and the French aren't sharing any information about what they gave them or what the outcome was. So there is a need internationally to get on the ball here and say, look, if you're going to try drugs, try vaccines, some of this experimental stuff, you must report what you gave, you must share data. We don't even have that in place, and that irritates me as well.
One last Ebola question for me. So if we're going to criticize the government for their inability to work intra-agency and all that sort of stuff and come up with protocols, they appoint you tomorrow, the czar of this, and say, in 24 hours, come up with the protocols about how we deal with this. Could you do it?
Sure. I'd take Jim and Marjorie and quarantine
really?
Them immediately.
Could you do it?
I think you could do it, I don't know, 24 hours. Give me 72, and I think we could have websites humming and people understand what they're supposed to do in different situations, get the cops and the firemen on board so they know how to respond, designate on maps where to take somebody if they appear to have Ebola serious symptoms and make you understand what those serious symptoms are. I think we could do better. I mean, for all this 24/7 Ebola around the clock, there's just a media opportunity there, too, to keep educating.
Can I just say one last thing about this? As we're speaking, I'm watching CNN, and it's nonstop what you mentioned. Ebola patient's dog may be euthanized. Mm. I guarantee you there are going to be more comments, more email, more letters to the editor about this dog, for which I have sympathy, than for the humans who have contracted Ebola. Mark my words. We'll talk about it next
time. Here's a grim fact. There have been many more demonstrations about animal experimentation than human experimentation.
I'm not surprised.
I'd say the ratio is probably about 50 to 1.
That's one of our favorite subjects, Art. Actually, we don't get to talk to you that much about it. But anyway, let's move on to another thing that is just talk about your worst nightmare. We're talking, by the way, with Art Kaplan. He's our medical ethicist from NYU's Langone Medical Center. The headline kind of says it all. If you're facing surgery, this may well be your worst nightmare. This is from the Washington Post. Waking up while under the knife without the medical staff knowing and unable to let the doctors know. My goodness, Art. I mean, talk about sending people into a panic. People are talking about feeling paralyzed. They couldn't tell the doctors. It wasn't so much, well, they did feel some pain, but it was also the paralysis and the sense that you were choking and being buried alive.
And happy Halloween to us all. So,
yeah.
This is a problem. It is a problem that anesthesiologists are very well aware of. The problem is triggered by the fact that you're trying to balance not giving too much anesthesia, not causing the person to not wake up or causing some sort of cardiac or brain damage versus making sure they stay under and, that isn't an issue. I think at the end of the day, the good news is when that happens, most of the time people don't really remember it long term, although I won't say people don't remember it at all. Some do, but many don't. And I think you've got to decide which way you're going to err. Hopefully, we'll figure out some kind of sign system or some kind of even monitoring technique, stress measures on the skin or something to say this person may be alert, even though we're not getting any kind of behavior because we've also paralyzed them so they don't move around when we're operating on them. That's about as good as I can do. It's a tough,
how often is this a scary problem?
Well,
talk about scary and nightmares. How often, what percentage of surgeries does a person, quote, wake up, end quote?
Very rare. It's usually the ones that are where you're under for hours. It's not the one where you come in and somebody sets your shoulder because you had a fall or something like that.
So don't worry, Marjorie.
Yeah, but one last thing on this, Art Kaplan. We've all had fillings, you know, at the dentist.
Yeah.
And it, obviously some people need more Novocaine than other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if this is the same sort of thing that there's and they're not, you know, they're not necessarily people that are, you know, 6'5 and 300 pounds. They just for whatever reason are more sensitive to pain or something.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you know that? How does the anesthesiologist know that if you're one of these people that needs a real heavy-duty dose?
Yeah, so here's good news for the better tomorrow, where we can all look forward to the rising sun.
This made me very nervous, Art. I must say.
What's going to happen pretty soon is they're going to give you a little bit of a genetic test, see whether you're a high metabolizer of anesthesia or a low one.
Uh-huh.
And that's going to be what you want, Marjorie.
You're
going to wind up having a predictability about whether you do well with pain meds or you don't metabolize them too fast or you turn them over in your body fast. That is one area where genetic testing is going to help.
By the way, you don't know Marjorie Egan. I've known her for a long time. We're going to be talking about this every day for months. Trust me. I'm telling
well,
you,
I've never
every
even
day.
Had anesthesia,
okay,
but someday,
haven't?
No, I I've haven't.
Hey, Marjorie, by the way, you know, this is it's a cousin issue to what we're scaring listeners about right now, if any of them are still listening after this discussion. One of the great fears of the 19th century was premature burial, so they used to make all coffins with a little string and a bell so you could ring it if you got put in there too fast.
By the way, that's in my will. Actually, that's in my will. It's funny you should say that. I've got the bell. I don't want the bell. You know, moving to a really serious topic, and I have to say I hadn't heard of this before. There is a report out, a book, actually, a new book that was published this week that talks about United States troops and patients who were used as malaria guinea pigs, I guess, in the 1940s. And while we knew something about this, I mean, most of us have heard, of course, of the horrors of the Tuskegee syphilis study, where these low-income black men were basically mm-hmm. guinea pigs and weren't told about it for years and did this horrible suffering. What's this malaria deal?
During World War II, and it's true in all wars, I think I'm going to block the name of this guy's book, Jared Diamond, an anthropologist doctor, wrote a wonderful book. It's something like Guns, Steel, and War or something like that. The point of which was, in war, your biggest enemy usually isn't the other guy, it's disease. And so typhus and typhoid and cholera and malaria. You're fighting in World War II in the Pacific Theater. You got all kinds of people getting sick, too many troops down. You're looking desperately for some kind of a solution. By the way, in the European theater, that's exactly what was going on in the concentration camps, where people were being given typhus as armies desperately sought some type of a solution to that disease, the flea-borne one. Long and short of it is, troops put into studies, not really told what's going on, made sick, some of them died. They didn't really get informed consent. They didn't really even sometimes tell them that they were doing experiments. So a lot of what we know today about malaria was built on the back of these horrible experiments. I have to tell you, boy, we are really in the grim zone today. But there's a lot of folks, uranium miners in the American Southwest, who were mining uranium for the Cold War, getting exposed to radiation. A lot of what we know about radiation exposure and safety comes from those guys. They were never told that we knew that they were getting sick, and we're watching them get sick because we wanted them to keep mining. So
what's the bottom line? I mean, I know you're not going there, I don't think, but are you basically saying in those two circumstances that you described that because we did get so much life-saving knowledge out of this that we have to swallow hard and say this is what we've got to endure to save mankind?
I am.
Really?
I'm going to go there. And I'm going to go there in a little bit of a very deliberate route because I had to think about this issue of data from horrible experiments. There are huge numbers of horrible experiments in the history of medicine, experiments on slaves, brutal experiments on animals, just some horrible things done to lots of people in lots of places. You're never going to be able to exorcise that information out of medicine. We can't sort of forget what we know about malaria. So my suggestion is, if you're going to cite this data, don't cite it with the researchers' names. Don't give credit. You don't want to honor people who did bad things. Explain that the stakes are high in the papers, in the books, to the students and say, this is why we're using it, but it was wrong to do it this way. And then make sure that whenever it's mentioned, you bring up the fact that it was acquired immorally. You've really got to try to explain and make sure that people don't come away thinking, you know, at the end of the day, it's just getting the data that matters. They don't care how I did it.
Yeah, but Art, so let's assume someone goes to you today and there's some horrible disease that is raging throughout the world. Maybe it's Ebola in mm-hmm. 6 months. And they say to you,
oh,
Art
good.
Kaplan,
thank you.
You're the one who has to sign off on this secret, non-transparent testing on unsuspecting subjects, because mm-hmm. ultimately it's going to save millions of lives. You sign off?
We almost are in that situation. So if I'm going to roll out experimental drugs into West Africa, poor, illiterate people, countries falling apart, and I say, give me your informed consent to try this on you, I don't really believe they can. I mm-hmm. don't believe they can. So the other protection has to be, I better have a group of scientists, physicians, and maybe some local, more literate people ready to say, we give our approval, because I don't think I can honestly rely on the desperately ill, illiterate person's consent. We fantasize, we do it in ethics, we do it in law, that that's going to be enough. I don't believe that.
Hey, Art, we're going to leave the Grimm Zone for 1 minute before we let you go, because you really have kept us there. There is this new thing that Marjorie and I are just wildly into. There's a study that shows, I know this is not new, that loneliness is one of the great horrors for older people. And there's been the creation of something called an anti-loneliness or tranquility chair, which essentially has big, huge – well, describe what it does, Marjorie.
Well, it's this huge, enormous doll with blonde curls, blob nose, odd hat, extra-long doorstop sausage arms, which you can wrap around you in a comforting way to get a hug when you're feeling lonely.
By the way, that's my wife's description of me. Go on.
Okay. I mean, it's a very funny piece written by this woman in The Guardian who thinks this is a terrible idea. You'd be better off just to go visit Grandma or have Grandma have some visitors. But what do you think? This does sound off. The Japanese have come up with this, by the way, because a quarter of the population over there is over 65. What do you think of the wraparound hug doll, Art?
The future of intimacy is the robot. The future of intimacy is probably going to include the throw pillow friend with the long, cushy arms.
You're serious, right?
I think they're coming. Yep. I do. And I think, you know, it's no substitute for a real human visit. I'm not arguing that. But for various reasons, some people don't get visits. For various reasons, some people are just alone because their family isn't around or they've outlived them or whatever. Society could do better providing real humans to come and talk to them and hug them and have interactions with them. We don't seem inclined to do it. I know you're going to hate this, Marjorie, but I think that's in the future.
Okay. I think – but why not the cat or the small dog?
Oh, I'm on. That's fine, too.
Yeah, okay.
Probably both of them will be robots, so they're easier to take care of and your neighbors don't yell at you for – not picking up,
okay.
But yeah, I get the spirit.
Marjorie, okay. This worked for Joaquin Phoenix, yeah. Or whatever his name is in that movie.
Oh, right. Didn't he?
Yeah, he did, exactly.
Cell phone or something?
An operating system. Hey, Art, before you go, in a couple of minutes, we're going to ask the listeners about this. A time capsule that was sealed 113 years ago at the Old State House is going to be open tomorrow. We're going to ask people what they would put in a time capsule.
You're going to find my letter sweater. Go on. Yeah.
If it were filled today, considering the world in which you come, what would you put in a time capsule tomorrow?
You know, I'd probably put in a DNA printout and sort of say, this is what we knew, this is what we thought about our ancestry, our origins, this is what we thought about who we were. See whether in 50 years they don't break out in laughter when they take the thing out of the box, but it gives them a snapshot of our kind of our understanding of ourselves. So I might do that.
What a great idea, Art Kaplan. That's what we'd love to talk to you.
That's what I was going to say, Mark.
Yeah, okay. Art Kaplan,
great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for being with us as always. And it was cheerful toward the end there, Art. Don't worry about it. Art Kaplan.
I'm nervous. Like, oh, God. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the host of a terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. Coming up tomorrow, a time capsule, 113-year-old time capsule, which was discovered at the Old State House. It's going to be opened. What do you think will be inside it? And what would you put into a 2014 time capsule? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.